Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Motherload Podcast. We are your alternative parenting show. I'm Constance Zimmer.
And I'm Missy Pyle.
Listen, we all know parenting is fucking messy. Everything you see is a lie. We all know it.
And we want to rip the Band-Aid off of being a parent. Oh my God, Missy, it's the holidays.
Gobble, 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 gob. I'm gonna gobble up some gobbled gobble.
What if you don't eat turkey? What's the sound of?
That's why I said I'm gonna gobble up some gobble, gobble. Like, you know, like whatever you want to eat. You could have a turkey, a tofurkey, maybe you can have a little squash casserole with some green beans and mushroom sauce.
Have you had a tofurkey before?
I had one once when I was not eating. I was a vegan for a short amount of time. Name dropping. Let me pick this up. I was living in Alicia Silverstone's house when I, after I left Montana, I came back. I didn't have any money. We'd done a movie together. So I stayed in her house. And I didn't feel like I could cook. I could bring any kind of, you know, meat product or any animal product in
Yeah, because she's complete vegan.
Completely vegan. I started a vegan blog, and we was a vegan for like almost a year.
I was a vegetarian for 5 years.
Yeah. Tell me more.
Do you still do any day where you do vegan? Because you know for the earth, we should all be doing at least one day a week, no meat.
I eat mostly a vegan diet, and I didn't eat meat for like 7 years, and then recently I was like, I must eat a steak.
I love food. I really do. And I have to say, it's my thing with Thanksgiving has been such an interesting trajectory in my life, because I do feel like it used to be such a big deal and families would come together, you know, new families like brother-in-laws and all this stuff. People would come together and you would eat. And slowly but surely, as the years would go, somebody would complain about something. Kids. I blame the kids. Kids are like, I don't really like cranberry sauce. I don't really like mashed potatoes. I don't want green beans. And then it started being like, okay, so let's make super delicious Italian version Thanksgiving meals. That upped it, made it a little bit more exciting, you know, taking traditional, but giving it a spin. And then, you know, my mom, I think one year was like, I don't like turkey.
Oh, once you open that can of worms.
Right. And, you know, it's like, why go through all of that? It's a lot to make Thanksgiving meals and try and appease everybody.
When else do you go to someone's house and they're like, I roasted a turkey? And that does not happen in December. Well, maybe for like the holiday, the Christmas or the, I don't know if it.
People do ham, I think.
Yeah, but I feel like January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, no one is having a roasted turkey. Maybe you get turkey, you know, breast on your sandwich and then you fall asleep from the quinine. Is it quinine? No, what is it?
I don't know, but you know what?
What is it that turkey has?
Tryptophan. But I think that's been debunked.
Oh, really?
If you look it up, New York Times, it's where I get all my news. I think it's been debunked.
Lefty.
But... But what I'm trying to say is the holidays are incredibly stressful, right? So everybody gets the time off. They raise the prices for travel when it's the one time you're supposed to go see your family if they're not local. You are all in one house together.
Ugh, I have the hives just thinking about it.
Do you go away for the...
You know what? This year and the last couple years, I have decided to say fuck you to holiday travel. And I went to see my family on November 1st. My niece had a little wedding, and no one else is traveling. And it's delightful. I got round trip tickets for Zoe and I for $300 total, maybe $350. Okay, maybe it was closer to $400. But it was cheap. And we went and saw my family and hung out with everybody. It was stress free. And then I'm going to go see my mom with Zoe the first week of January, because it's bullshit that the only time you have off to be with your family, like Josh and I don't get to see each other that much except the weekends, and like to spend like 10 solid days together in our house without anybody, you know, using the guest bathroom. Like, it's really fucking nice. And so I'm saying I think more people should boycott the actual holiday travel and go.
Holiday travel sucks. I mean, we're actually going to Nashville to go see Russ's family.
And start a country music career?
If only, Missy. You should come with me.
I will.
But we're doing that because it's not as easy for them to travel. And because it's a holiday, we have more days off. So in this situation, we are doing it by choice. But if I could do it not during a holiday, I would. But she works, you know, and we can't go any other time. But what we're doing is we're only going from Sunday to Wednesday. So we're actually coming back before the actual like Thanksgiving day. Because we're compromising. We're doing half what we feel like we need to do and half what we would like to do. We'll see how that works because we are traveling on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving just to come back. But I'll be curious to see how that goes.
The holidays and parenting are all about compromise.
That's right. Okay, we are going to give you Ailette Waldman now. And Ailette Waldman is an Israeli-American novelist and essayist. She has written 7 mystery novels in the series The Mommy Track Mysteries and 4 other novels, including the one that we are obsessed with, Bad Mother, which is a chronicle of maternal crimes, minor calamities, and occasional moments of grace.
Which is holy shit unbelievable. Like her honesty and her journey and just who she is. Like, she is a force, you know? I'm just kind of blown away by her. I can't wait.
Her story is very exciting. Her writing is incredibly exciting. And now she's moving into television. She also wrote the autobiographical essays that are about motherhood. And there is now a Netflix show, if you can believe it, because it's called...
It's Unbelievable. And it's on right now, and you can check it out.
Yeah. Anyways... I can't wait for you guys.
Put your hands together.
Here we go. Ailette Waldman, everyone.
My daughter has never repeated a swear word that I've said.
Just nice. Right.
I don't know, but she's like my friend, I was with another friend who was like, oh, I've got to get some cigarettes. And her son was like, what's a cigarette, Mom? Oh, God. It's like...
Nothing. It's a nothing thing. You know, my kids never, ever repeated my swears. And in fact, they like would condemn me for it. And then I was looking at someone's text stream. You know, I snagged the phone and opened it up just to make sure they were not doing all the things that it turned out they were doing. And every other word was like, fucking fuck the fuck. And I was like, oh, I thought they didn't. They seemed so nice.
But it's because they're not saying it out loud. They're writing it. Yeah. They're texting it.
Oh, they're probably saying it. They're just not saying it in front of us.
True.
Because they're embarrassed.
Coco says that a lot of kids at her school swear up and down, like on the playground. And they're all 11. And she says she looks at them like as if they're aliens because she just doesn't understand why they even need to talk that way. But they're just doing it because they can.
Right, right.
It's powerful, right?
Exactly.
Not supposed to.
And plus, they do it the same way we do it. It's a good punctuation mark. It makes you feel tough or whatever.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Fuck yeah.
But I remember Russ was cursing in the car the other day because we were late and there was traffic and people were driving like assholes like they always do. And he was like, oh, fuck. And she's like, Dad. And then he's like, okay, I'm sorry. And then 5 minutes later, he's like, shit, Dad, you know what? If I had a swear jar right now, I would be rich.
Do you have a swear jar?
No, we don't. We've never had a swear jar ever in our house.
Do you know what we have? We have a self-loathing jar that the kids made for me because of all the shit I say about myself. So they actually made me this. They got a jar. They wrote self-loathing. And anytime I say anything hateful about myself, they make me put in a dollar. They are so loaded. They're just like racking in. That's where they get their, you know, spending money from.
I really like that because what that's doing is it's putting it on you to be better and kinder to yourself.
Absolutely.
And that your kids are aware of it.
Which makes you wonder like how shitty I was to myself for so long. It was like this knee-jerk thing, this like self-deprecating humor that's actually not really humor. It's really this terrible thing you feel about yourself and – And they got it. I was so proud of them for like noticing, but it's really, it's a little bit horrifying when you see the jar fill up with bills.
By the way, I would just like to say that I really truly feel that I am you and you are me.
Well, that's exciting.
No, because when I read your book, I was like, oh, that's me. I do that. Oh, my husband does that. Oh, I do that with my kid. Oh, and I thought, oh, this is great. So, and then I thought, wait, does that mean I'm a bad mother? Like, it's funny because
no, no,
of,
the whole point is that you're not. You're
no, you're not. And that's why I want to say I appreciate you writing this book so much, because it's a lot of the reasons why Missy and I wanted to do this kind of alternative parenting podcast, because we feel too many people are not being honest,
right?
And they're filtering the ugly stuff. And
right,
we wanted to talk about the ugly stuff and the hard stuff and the dark stuff and remind people that we're not all alone. And so it was, it felt really good to say, oh, so that's not bad.
Right.
You know, and I appreciate honesty far more than people hiding.
Right.
And we were talking
about this kind of Instagrammable life. I feel like it's gotten so much worse now because all these people, it's almost, they do this thing where it's like faux bad mother. Like, you know, they, it's this humble, braggy Instagram life that I look at it and I'm just like, fuck, I'm so glad I don't have a little 4-year-old right now. And I'm looking at people, you know, humble bragging about the mess their kid made when they spent 6 hours baking and cooking in the kitchen, and look at this beautiful cake they made for daddy. And I'm like, oh yeah, I stopped at Safeway and this is the cake we made for daddy.
Yeah.
2 days after his birthday.
So
I forgot.
You made this, you wrote this article, you know, this article. What was the name of the one that you wrote that was?
So the New York Times titled it Truly, Madly, Guiltily. After What I Have to Say is one of my favorite movies, but I don't even remember what I called that chapter. But yeah, it. I wrote this article. I wrote it for a literary anthology. Nobody was supposed to read it. These friends of mine were putting together this sort of book on motherhood, and they had like the woman writing about having breast cancer and the woman writing about getting divorced and all, you know, all this stuff. And they said to me, okay, Ayala, you have to write about sex because you're the only one who's having any. And I was like, all right. And I thought at first I would write this like Dr. Ruthie, like how to have a wonderful sexual relationship with your husband, even when you have 4 children. But I got dark really fast. And like all of these feelings I had about being a shitty mother and all these feelings I had about like other people being more content and more loving than I was just kind of bubbled to the surface. So I ended up writing this piece that basically said, if, you know, if a good mother is supposed to love her children more than anybody else in the world, well, then I'm a really shitty mother because I love my husband more than my children. So, yeah. And this was, you know, sort of just in the beginning of that kind of public shaming internet thing. And I get hit with this tsunami. And I'm glad it didn't happen now because I probably would never be able to show my face in public. But thousands of emails. Someone put a note on my front gate that said, we know where you live and your children should be taken away from you. I mean, what the fuck?
And just because you were saying that you loved your husband yeah, more, not like.
Exactly. And like I was saying it as a rhetorical device too. It's like, obviously, more isn't right. I mean, it's all different. But, you know, now actually, my kids are mostly gone. I have one kid who's in high school and he's at boarding school. So I am so glad that I had those feelings because now it's just the two of us. And I see these people who are a little older than me whose kids are all at college and they're sitting in these like – the best case scenario is like a companionate marriage where they like to travel together and they enjoy having the occasional meal together. And the worst case scenario is they're looking at each other and they're like, who the fuck are you and why have I spent 25 years with you?
Right.
And they're dropping like flies, man.
To me, you know, like I love my kid. I had – several miscarriages. I finally adopted privately my daughter. And then I was alone at the time. I was dating a guy who I had two miscarriages with.
Oh my God.
I know. I actually found out – this is a lot of information.
No, and, this is what we're here for.
It's I like, found seriously, out, we're going to go. I mean,
yeah. I found out that – so I got pregnant with him immediately. And then I said, listen, I just realized I'm not great at being alone. Like I'd been with this – I'd been married twice. I was with this one guy. And we had three miscarriages. We ended up getting divorced. And then
wow, that's a lot.
I know it's a lot. Listen, it's a lot. I realize this is a lot.
No, that's a lot. Not.
But it's my fucking story. And for 8 years, I was a fucking basket case. Right.
You have to read this book called Waiting for Daisy by my friend Peggy Ornstein. Yeah. Go on.
I'll send it to you. I'm going to write this story. I've written parts of it, but I'd love to. Yes. And so I would see a pregnant woman and just, I had just had my second miscarriage, and I had to give co-host a baby shower for three pregnant women.
Oh my God.
I think it was my second or third. And I remember going in the bathroom and just being like, you know, I think I just had another. Anyway, and I finally, I was dating this guy he's still in my life, and he's always dad now, but he's not officially your dad. But I was in the process. My adoption profile was live to adopt by myself. And I was May and I got pregnant. And I was like, wow. Oh, fuck. And then I called my fertility doctor, and I just said, and we went in and I had my blood tested on Monday, my levels checked. And I had said, by Friday, if it's viable, I'm going to put my profile on ice for the adoption. And so on Friday, I was waiting for the results. My numbers were dropping. And I took my dog on a hike, who couldn't really walk very well. And I was out of cell service, and I kept going, come on, come back. She's like, and I'm like, I'm waiting for this doctor who's so busy. If you miss her, you're not going to get her until the evening. And so I get back to my car and I see that there's a message, and I'm like, fuck, I missed it. And so we get into cell service, and I get a call saying, hi, Missy, it's Catherine from Adopt Help. Congratulations, you've been selected by a birth mother. I was like, holy shit, holy shit. And so I called my friend Christine, and I was like, holy shit, holy shit. And then my doctor called and said, you know, your pregnancy's not viable. I'm sorry. I'm like, is it
100%? Those calls weren't reversed.
30 minutes. I know. It was.
Oh my God.
It was pretty crazy. And so I had to come and tell this guy I was dating, like, hey, our pregnancy is not viable. But I just got a call saying, you know, birth mother selected me, and the child will be born in September. And like, if you want, like, I will try. I will let this go. Like, we could do IVF. Wow. You know, if you want to try that, I'm willing to try that. But like, and he's like, no, you've waited so long. Like, you do this. And then it was a pretty tumultuous, like, 6 months for us.
Yeah.
And
how long had you been dating at the time?
6 months.
Wow.
Yeah. And so... anyway,
I mean, we got knocked up so fast too. Like, you know, I was so young, and when you're young, you can basically, you know, pop out a baby at the prom. So,
which some have done.
Which some have done. So I mean, I was in my 20s, and we got completely stoned one night and went out with a couple who were really miserable. And we were like, we're so great. We're awesome. We should reproduce. And the next morning I was like, oh, fuck, come on. No, I had just started a job. I was like, that's
a bad
idea.
Like, we read your book, but this part of it, you know, you had this huge job. Like, you were a prosecutor.
No, public defender.
Oh, you were a public defender.
Here in
that's
LA,
right.
I was representing, I represented like the Mexican mafia.
Yeah, and you loved it, right?
I loved it. I loved that job so much. And it was kind of perfect for me because, you know, I had this dramatic sensibilities. And this is one of the only jobs in law you can do where you actually go to court. And I would dress for court. Especially when I was pregnant, I would dress in these like little sort of little sweet, almost Mormon outfits with these like little collars. And, you know, I'd waddle into court and I'd be next to some like big, monstrous, horrible drug dealer who like, you know, was caught with whatever billion weapons and piles of methamphetamine. And he would like, I'd have him pull out my chair for me and I'd sit down and he would be very solicitous and the jury would be like, oh, look, he can't be that bad. He's being so nice to that tiny little pregnant lady. Yeah, it was fun. It was super fun. And there I was pregnant. And the crazy thing is that I got pregnant, and then I got pregnant. I went back to work on a Monday. I puked on a Wednesday, and I was like, oh, no, 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 no. Because I'd been using – I mean, you're going to be like, fuck you. But I've been using birth control.
That's okay.
I was so careful, but I was breastfeeding, and I did a pregnancy test, and I was pregnant again. And I had the abortion by Friday because I was like, this – I can't have two children, you know. A little over a year apart and try to do this job. And I know it's like super fashionable. I have had an abortion that I regretted and that, you know, sent me into a 6 month depression. But that one, the only thing I felt walking out of my doctor's office was like, woohoo, thank God.
As women, we have to be allowed to make those decisions, whether right? they're the easy ones or the hard ones, because they're never easy.
Right.
But now we are living in a time, thank God. Well, I mean, I say thank God.
For the next 5 minutes.
That women are not right. being ashamed right. to admit that they've had abortions
so.
And not feel like they're going to go and get stoned, you know, right. in the center of the cobblestone.
And I think that's street. Because I
unless
think
you live in
Georgia, Alabama,
or like half the country,
half the country.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, that's one of the reasons I try to drop it into as many conversations as possible. Like, it was fine when I was talking about the one that nearly killed me. The one, I mean, I talk about this, I think, in the book where
yeah.
I had this abortion where I was pregnant. I desperately wanted the baby, and the baby had a genetic abnormality, and we decided to terminate. And I'll talk about that. And I have for a long time. And I was like in a support group and it was really, really brutal. I mean, I don't think my depression ended until I saw the, you know, little pink line in the pregnancy test. But the ones I've had two that I didn't regret at all. One when I was, you know, 47. What? Also using birth control. The doctors kept walking into the office and being like, wait, how old are you? Huh. But
it's
you know,
crazy.
I didn't feel anything but like relief at that moment. And I didn't feel anything but relief when I was pregnant, like 5 minutes after I gave birth to Sophie. So I'm a really bad mother.
No, but again, to your point, not a bad mother.
No, no.
I love Flamingo.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. I love this razor. Like the way it feels. It's fancy, but it's only like $16. You can get a new blade. They'll send you one for $2. The shave gel. I've been using soap for like 25 years. It makes me feel fancy. The lotion, I put it on my arms. Not necessarily, not just my legs. I love Flamingo, okay?
I like the holder.
Stop yelling at me.
I'm just going to tell you, normally my razor sits at the bottom of my shower mm-hmm. or on the shelf. The holder for the razor is fantastic. I mean, all of it is fantastic.
Look, hair removal can be a chore, but that's okay. The Flamingo shave set is anything but routine. It's $22 value, $16 with free shipping.
And that comes with the razor, 2 cartridges, 1 body lotion, 1 shave gel, 1 shower hook, and a reusable travel pouch.
Think about it. You probably spend more than $16 on razors and blades already. With the Flamingo shave set, you can upgrade for less or the same as you're paying now.
Yeah. Get your Flamingo shave set for just $16 with free shipping today when you visit
shopflamingo.com/motherload.
It's almost the holidays. Ding, ding, ding.
Dum, da-dum, dum, 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 dum. It's that time of year again. Time to share smiles and good times with friends and family. And of course, exchange gifts.
How about you give yourself a gift? Yeah, the gift of self-confidence. How do you get it? By having straighter, brighter teeth with help from
Candid. Candid's aligners can help straighten your teeth faster and cheaper than traditional wire braces. Treatment takes just 6 months on average and costs 65% less.
Experienced orthodontist who is licensed in your state creates a custom treatment plan. Then they show you a 3D preview so you can see how your teeth will look after you're done.
The aligners are comfortable, removable, completely invisible.
There's no hassle of going into an orthodontist's office. Yuck. Candid ships your aligners directly to you.
Plus, in the season of giving, Candid donates $25 with each aligner purchased to Smile Train, who brings safe 100% free cleft, lip, and palate treatment to children around the globe.
Give yourself the gift of Candid, okay? Go to CandidCO.com/motherload and use code motherload to get $75 off.
That's CandidCO.com/motherload, code motherload for $75 off.
CandidCO.com/motherload, code motherload.
The whole reason I went into my long story was that I have this 4-year-old who is not biologically mine, who I love more than anything in the mm-hmm. world, but she's a total bitch to me at least 30 to 40% of the time. Like, we're having a great time, then she'll, you know, and then she hits me, and you know, it's like
four is horrible. Do you remember four? Four is
worst. I barely remember four.
Never tried to hit her.
No.
Mine is like 3 times a day on, you know, but she's also like the sweetest. I love you so much, mommy. Right. I love you. And then something will happen and she'll get mad and she'll try to, and I always say like, I can't let you do that. I can't. And then finally, like, you know, but to me, like, I love her, but to say that I love her more than anything in the world, like I love her, but she is her, the reciprocation of that love is very complicated. Right. And I really like my partner.
Yeah.
I really like the steadiness right. of that love. I like the sex. We're in our late 40s and it's still really good. And it's new because we've only been together for like right. 5 years, but like, I get it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I really love her, but like, boy, do I love nights away from her.
I know. And sometimes I say, like, if you have a baby with an off switch, like you could turn the baby or the top, like how much of the day would that baby be on? Like really, especially when they're like 2 and a half, how much of the day really would you be like, I want to be around you while you eat your food, while you have a tantrum, while I try to get you out of the house in the morning? If you could just like turn the baby off and be like, now we're going to get dressed. I'm going to put you in the car. And then I can like turn you back on for the car ride when you're super cute. I feel like that's like the saving grace of children is that you can't turn them off. Or it's like 11 at night and you're desperately trying to go to sleep. And there's this little creature who feels like, oh, now it's time to, you know, read 17 books and jump up and down and decide I have a stomach ache and whatever.
But do you think some part of the desire, and I don't have 4 children, obviously, and so that's a bigger,
larger.
Yeah, we feel bad complaining and we only have 1 kid.
Oh, dude, come on. I mean, the thing about 4 is that they take care of each other, you know?
Yes.
I mean, I come from a family of 6, so I definitely wanted a large family. And I do like... The truth is I actually genuinely love spending time with children and, you know, babies and toddlers. And but after a while, you just can't, right? So you end up practicing this kind of benign neglect where, you know, my Sophie, my older daughter, taught my younger daughter, she potty trained her. Because I was hugely pregnant and couldn't focus and had 4 kids. And like my ankles were the size of basketballs. And I had a book due. And all of a sudden, and Rosie needed to like get to preschool because I needed to register for preschool so that she could be in school when the baby came, but she wasn't yet 2 and they had rules about diapers. And then all of a sudden Sophie comes out one day and she says, completed, done. Oh my Here God. Is your potty trained baby. And I'm like, oh honey, please, that's not true. But you know, a bag of M&Ms later, that kid had been totally potty trained by an 8-year-old.
We did an episode about potty training and you know, I potty trained my kid with marshmallows and M&Ms too. Uh-huh. And how much people would say, you can't do that. You can't reward kids for going, you know, it's blah, blah, blah. And it's been such a fun topic because every parent obviously has.
Why can't you reward them?
There's just so much
the theory?
Fucking information out there. And everyone's like, you have to do this. We have to do this. And people now, I mean, holy fuck. It's so crazy.
Well, I think it has to do with this idea that this is the most valuable, important thing you've ever done, right? You are creating this being. And all I felt like was like, what am I going to do to fuck these kids up? How am I – what mistakes am I going to make that are going to ruin them for the rest of their lives? And when you feel that kind of insecurity, then you feel like the decisions you make have to be the best decisions. So if you decided to potty train with M&Ms, then not potty training with M&Ms has to be completely wrong. Or if you, you know, by some fucking miracle, taught a kid to go on the potty without M&Ms, I don't know how, then that's the best decision. Or it's like co-sleeping. Like if you choose to sleep with your baby, then not sleeping with your baby is a horrible decision. And if you choose not to sleep with your baby, then sleeping with you can't like tolerate the idea that someone is doing it better because then you've failed your kid.
Well, it's the whole comparing yourself to others and how they're doing it. And I think that's something that you wrote, many things you wrote in your book, but I love how you said that each one of your kids has been parented by a different parent, even though it's been you the whole time. Totally. And I loved that so much. That's something I will never get to experience because I do only have one and I wanted to, but I had my first one later in life that then I was already had an established career and I was like, I actually don't have the time. I'm going to have one and I'm going to be happy
with it. So now she'll be president because only children are always infinitely more successful.
Fantastic.
I try to burden my kids with like, with every kid, they had less of a chance of actually achieving in life.
Yeah. Well, and we talked to her. Are you an only
child? Our producer's an only child.
She's going to be president. And she's very smart. She is. But we talked to Coco about being an only child and the bonuses and the minuses. And, you know, her only minus was like, well, you don't have a play date. whenever you want it, you know, but she goes, otherwise I'm great. But I just love the idea because I think you're one of the first people that I have read and been very influenced by the reality that every kid is different, not because they were even necessarily born different, but because they were parented differently by the same parents.
Right.
Because you've learned more, you care less. You know what I mean? Like, as the more you go on, like, you have how many kids in your family again? You're the youngest.
There's five, and then my dad remarried and had two more.
So oh,
seven.
Wow.
That's seven. A lot. Yeah.
And so Missy talks about, you know, feeling like she was an only child, even though she had four other siblings.
Well, when my parents got divorced, I moved with my mom to Tennessee. And I was an only child all of a sudden. And I, with these
wow,
two.
Wow, what happened to the other kids?
Well,
you were the youngest?
I was the youngest. And then my dad remarried and he's had those two in Texas. But my parents, my mom and my stepdad had this gross physical, they were disgusting. Like the way they would go in for a kiss and his tongue would always come out just a little bit first. And they were gross. It was so gross. And I had all this freedom now because they put the TV in my room because
busy fucking in the other
room. Oh, so gross. And I was like 13, just doing whatever I needed to. I mean, anyway.
Oh, man.
But I wanted to talk to you about that too, is you said when all else fails, tell the truth.
Yeah.
And something that we've touched on a little bit in another episode, which was about when to tell the truth and when to just flat out lie.
So my rule is I don't lie to my kids, but I don't feel like I owe them the entire truth. I mean, sometimes I have lied to them, but then I always it comes back to bite me in the ass. So here's the thing about drugs. I don't feel like you have to tell your kids everything about your drug use, but if you lie to them, they're going to figure it out eventually. So when the kids were little and they were listening to some Beatles song, you know, I Get High with a Little Help from My Friends, and one of the kids said to my husband, well, that's just happy, right? And he's like, no, that's high. And they were sitting there shocked, and then they said, well, Dad, have you ever gotten high? And he sort of gulped and he's like, all right, I'd yell, it says harm reduction, honesty. And he said to them, yes, I have. And they said, how many times? And he was like, do I say a million? What do I say? And then he said, that's daddy's business. And that was there you go. It's you don't owe them the whole truth. You know, if they start asking you questions specifics about your sex life, you don't have to tell them everything. But at some point I didn't tell my daughters, my sons have never asked, but I didn't tell my daughters how old I was when I lost my virginity and what the details of that experience were, because I didn't need to hear about the horrible 22-year-old guy and I was 14 and it was non-volition. They didn't need to hear any of that. But at some point I thought, you know what? They actually do need to hear the story. And now they're teenagers and I want them to feel like they have agency if they're in a sexual encounter like this. And so I did sit them down when they were each that age. And I said, this is what happened to me. This is how it affected me.
When they were 14?
About 14. Okay. Yeah.
See, because Coco has asked me, and she's 11. I think she asked me when she was 10, how old I was when I had sex.
Yeah. That's a hard one. I don't know if it's a hard one for you, if it's 22.
I was 15.
Yeah. I think you decide when you feel comfortable telling them, but you don't have to tell them. You don't have to give them the details of it.
Yeah. You know? And I haven't. And that was all she wanted to know.
Yeah.
And she just wanted to know, was it a boyfriend? Was it somebody I loved?
Right.
She wants to know those kinds of,
right.
And I have no problem telling her all that stuff. But I did in your chapter when you talk about how you were so sexually active as a young girl and how you were debating how to talk about it with your girls. You know, I was that as well. And
me too.
My husband doesn't even want to know. He does not want to know.
Did you have that first conversation when you got together with, and you were doing that first, my husband was just sitting there he'd been hit by a car.
Yeah.
And I'm like, 14. Yeah, I think that was that. When I looked at him, he was like, let's just not talk about this again.
Yeah.
I'm going to sit with my single digit number and we're just not going to talk about this scenario again.
Yeah, that's why I said he doesn't want to.
Yeah.
I was approached to write a book about a certain section of my life before I met my husband and before I had Coco. And because I kept journals. Mm-hmm. I've kept journals since I was in fifth grade.
Oh, wow.
And wow. Yeah, it's intense. And they're intense. I mean, they are all about boys and feeling inadequate as a person and feeling right. that the only way I could gain a boy's affection is by showing affection and allowing them to, you know, do things that not other girls would let them do. You know, you have the whole totally. Thing about how we demonize and we call girls sluts because of this, that, and the other thing and all that. I wasn't that, but it's when I go back and I read that stuff, it pained my heart. And I thought, how can I make sure that my daughter doesn't go through these right. kinds of emotions like I did? And so that's why when she asks me questions like that, I feel like I do want to be honest with right. her and say, you know, yeah, I may have done this at a young age because I was insecure and I had all these issues that I wasn't pretty enough and I right. wasn't skinny enough. And I don't want you to have those in your life because I didn't benefit from it at all. But anyways, what I mean by going back and reading all those journals was one, it made me realize I need to talk to her about that stuff.
Right.
So that was great. But two, that I could never write this book because I don't know that I want her or my husband, and it's going to make me cry, but I don't know. It feels like a part of me that I don't necessarily know that I want to go back right. to.
Is it, do you feel like it's shame or do you feel like it's just the pain that you don't want to confront again? Do you feel like you don't want them to know this part of you?
It's not about knowing that part of me. I am not afraid or ashamed of the insecurity that I deal with on a daily basis. But being a mom,
right,
is makes it just a little bit more of a awareness. Right. I guess I know my husband could handle it; he'd be fine, right. even though he doesn't want to ever know anything about my life before, which I understand. And that's why, you know, reading your book is, it just feels so good that you are like, this is everything I am before you were here, before any of, you know, of this that my life is now, which makes you who you are today. And we all shouldn't be. And so it's just hard because I talk to her about a lot of things and she's like, how many boyfriends did you have at my age? And I'm like, well, I had three. And she's like, three? How'd you have three boyfriends? And I said, well, I mean, I wasn't really doing anything with them. I was only, you know, 11 or 12, but right. it was just that, you right, know, right. And we've been, we talked about on the show that, you know, I got like mommy shamed because I've been allowing my daughter at age 11 to have a boyfriend, quote unquote. And it's like, oh, I'm sexualizing a relationship between a boy and a girl and they're only 11. I'm like, I'm not telling them they should go and have right. sex. I'm just allowing them to feel those emotions. And it's helped her not feel stressed.
And I also think like, allow or not allow, it's going to happen. So what you're doing is you're saying, yeah. this is not something you should be ashamed of. This is something you know, you can talk to me about. Those other people, I mean, who knows what their kids are doing? You know, sitting in this room with all of us talking about like the same sexual history, I've had this experience over and over again with women who I love, women who are strong, women who are interesting. And I mean, two things are possible. One, we were all doing it and just imagining that they were girls who weren't. Or there's something about not doing it that makes, I don't know, you less interesting, less exciting, or at least not people I meet. You know what I mean? Like, what are the odds, right, that one of us isn't like, oh, no, I saved myself until I was 21 and was very careful.
I think that this thing of shame and, you know, this obviously like that's the master emotion,
totally.
Right? It's the one that's behind everything and it makes us all kind of, you know, and we so desperately don't want it to be real that we sort of, I feel like, run from it. And it's so, that was what was so, so exciting to me about reading your book. Like someone like Amy Schumer, too, who's just right. like, you know, with her pregnancy and her, you know, but like when you talk about your experiences, it literally like, it brought a little like to my heart, like opened me up. There was a little bit of healing that I think happens when we, but when we share, and I know that it's sometimes like, it's really hard to, you know, there are people in our lives that we don't like. I come from an extremely religious family, like super, super, Southern Baptist. I couldn't find the word, but the idea of like so much of me is not known by my immediate family, just to, I'm not known by them. Mm-hmm. And to be known by a woman, or if I'm mostly my women in my life are the ones who know me.
Right.
And to be known in spite of, or in addition or in joyfulness of like the things that we might see as shame. It's like
to be loved despite those things that we don't love about ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also like to
or maybe even because of them, you know?
Yeah. But also, and also who we are, who we came into the world, like the personalities that we had, and I'm not, obviously not a doctor, but I mean, and the experiences and the mother that we had at the time, like my mother was, I was her fifth. So my sister Julie taught me, potty trained me, did my diapers, all these things. So my, not only was my mother different, but now I had Julie, Debbie, Sam, and Paul, who all were, you know, in some kind of like bullying parental presence, you know, and it's like all of these people that you have, those things are part of you too. And a lot of times the things that are you aren't even you. And we are what reflections of other people that you've taken in. And then, so you kind of, you have shame for things that, like my dad was kind of abusive and I witnessed things and I have that in me and I feel shame about it. And it's like, but it's only there because I experienced it and it's a part of me, like that I don't necessarily, if I reflect on it, I don't really have to, I mean, I can own it, but it's also like, I don't have to blame myself for it.
Right. You just have to get that self-loathing jar. I mean, awareness is the first, for me, it's always been the first step, but that's like, I feel like shame is so much, I mean, I write it out because I, that's how I process. And also because I feel like it's almost like a cry in the woods. It's like, this thing makes me feel so bad. This thing is the hardest thing for me. Is there anybody out there? Is there anybody out there who feels the same way? Because there's comfort in, you know, you meet someone who, I meet you and you're so put together and so smart and so beautiful and so successful and so great and friendly. I can, you know, and then I'm like, well, if she's feeling what I'm feeling, then it's okay to feel that way. And you know, I feel like that, that's why I write everything that I write. It's almost like a, you know, I'm setting up this trial balloon. I'm, you know, it's not so much flying my freak flag. My husband said this once, that it's like, it's just sending up a flare. Like, are you out there? Is there anybody else out there?
Hey, everybody. It's Policy Genius time. And you know what that means? Time to think about your life insurance.
That's right. Shopping for life insurance can be deadly. It's scary.
No pun intended.
Right?
But listen, Policy Genius is the easy way to shop for a life insurance plan that is not tied to your job. So in minutes, you can compare quotes from top insurers to find your best price.
Yeah, and to properly provide for your family, most people need like 10 times the life insurance coverage than they get through their jobs, which means that your employer life insurance is leaving you underinsured.
Yeah, and the life insurance you buy through Policy Genius stays with you even if you leave your job.
Yeah, and the Policy Genius team is going to handle all that paperwork, all that red tape.
And Policy Genius doesn't just make it easy to get life insurance. They can also help you find the right home and auto insurance.
What?
And disability insurance too.
Wow, that's exciting.
Yes. So
when you're looking at your workplace benefits this month, make sure to double check your life insurance options.
Yes, then go to policygenius.com to get quotes and apply in minutes.
Policy Genius, the easy way to compare and buy life insurance.
You know what I hate? I hate overpaying for clothes that aren't worth it. So, Everlane, they want you to know what you're paying for and why. So guess what? They will tell you their real costs, and they are radically transparent about every step in their process, from the materials they use to the ethical factories they work with.
Yeah, they only make premium essentials, so no matter what your style or preference, Everlane's clothes look better, cost less, last longer because they sell directly to you. Their prices are 30 to 50% lower than traditional retailers.
I mean, listen, I have to say, I have a bazillion things from Everlane, and some of my favorite things are their cashmere sweaters.
Me too. I have two.
It's not a humble brag. It's an outright brag. Yeah, okay. I got some white leather boots that I'm very excited about that I'm rocking. Well, guess what? Right now, you can check out their personalized collection at everlane.com/motherload. Plus, you'll get free shipping on your first order.
That's everlane.com/motherload.
Everlane.com/motherload. Forever. Now, you obviously had a whole career before you now became such a prolific writer. When you made the shift, I mean, it forcibly happened because you wrote the article and then everyone was like, you need to do this more. You need to talk about this more. Have you found a lot more, I don't know if joy is the, but are you like, oh, this is what I was meant to do? Even though you loved doing what you did before you had kids, this has now become your voice.
So it really was an accident. Like, I was on maternity leave. I was pregnant with my second kid. I took a leave and was like, okay, I'm just going to sort of I'll take a year at home. And I didn't quit. I said to my boss, I walked into my boss's office and I was like, I'm going to quit because I'm going to spend some time with my kids, a year maybe. And she said, oh, please, you'll be back. I'm going to put you on leave. And it was, I had this experience of, you know, being in the playground and pushing my kid on a swing and being like, oh God, I'm so fucking bored. And looking over at this other mom and saying to her, oh my God, aren't you bored? Isn't this soul crushing? And she said, and I remember her saying this, but maybe she didn't say exactly this. She said, are you kidding? I just perfected my homemade Play-Doh recipe. And I was like, oh my God, nobody is like me. And I started writing this book of murder mysteries that we ended up calling them the Mommy Track Mysteries. And it was basically a way to just sort of write out all the feelings that I was having about. So here I was, this former public defender, stay-at-home mom, writing a book to keep herself from going crazy. And I wrote a character who's a former public defender, stay-at-home mom, who's solving crime to keep herself from going crazy. And
which I love, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
I really want to play that woman.
Or me.
We can talk. We can talk. So but what was so crazy about that is, like, I didn't plan on any of that. Like, I just did that to kill time. And because I needed something of my own, you know that feeling when your kids, especially when they're small, they're like, everything you have, they stick their fingers in your mouth and they eat your food and, like, they even drink your coffee if you have enough sugar in it. And I felt like I could either start smoking because they couldn't do that, or start writing because they couldn't do that either. So I started writing, and then the book sold. And then when my agent called and said the book had sold, she said, and I sold two more. And I was like, but I didn't write two more. So that's when I kind of tumbled into this inadvertent career. And I had loved my previous career. And I didn't know that I was going to love this. But in the end, I mean, writing can be horrible and wonderful. When it's going well, it's incredible. You feel like time passes without you even knowing it. You're in that state of flow. It's so exhilarating. And when you're having, like, these awful, miserable, confronting the truth of your own mediocrity moments, then I would be like, why aren't I just, when you're a public defender, you just have to confront the truth of other people's mediocrity, not your own. So it's definitely been like a process. But I would say now, having been a writer for 22 years, that I'm very glad that I'm doing it.
And now I think with your newest project, it's the two merging.
Right, exactly. So I'm getting to I was the executive producer of the show called Unbelievable that's on Netflix. And I've always tried to, like, find ideas that used a little bit of my background in law. But this is this amazing story about this young woman who was sexually assaulted and nobody believed her, not her foster moms, not the police. In fact, they prosecuted her for filing a false report. And when I read that article, I read it in it was in ProPublica and on this news magazine called The Marshall Project, which is all criminal justice stuff that I read because I'm interested in criminal justice. And as soon as I read that, I was like, oh, yeah, this is a TV show. And I've been thinking a lot about it lately because I write all these books and I write a little bit of TV. And as I was telling you, like, my books, you know, maybe 50,000, maybe 75,000 people read my books, which is great, you know, and then you do a podcast and more people hear about it. But like, I think 50, 55 million people saw Unbelievable.
Right.
And like, if I had written a book about what I think about, you know, that we have to believe women and these sexual assaults happen and that rape is on a spectrum and, you know, what happened to her is on this far end of the spectrum, but it's all, but it is the same spectrum as what happens to young girls in college. And if I had written that book, it would have been really satisfying and I could have made a great point and that 50,000, 75,000 people would have really appreciated. But now it's like really different and that you can affect the cultural conversation in a way that you just can't with books. But I guess probably my true heart is writing books just because well, maybe because you don't have to take so many notes.
Right.
Writing TV is a lot about notes.
Right. Right. Yeah, we know.
You
we
know.
Get those notes.
You
actors.
Get those notes too.
Listen, don't Listen. Say that line that way. I do, just really quickly, I do want to ask you a question that my friend, so, and you, do you know Lindsay Sloan?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Oh yeah. And her daughter just, I just saw her at my preschool. She's, her daughter just started at my preschool.
Well, there you go.
So, I thought she was going to come, but oh well.
She was, but she, her nanny just had to leave the country for a family emergency. So now she's stuck at home with her two girls. I say stuck, but she was actually the one that turned me on to your book.
Oh, good. And, thank you, Lindsay.
Yes. And she loves you so much. And I wanted her to at least feel like she could ask you something, even though she couldn't be here. So the question that she has is, as a mom of girls, what will you tell them, if they choose to have children, to try to help them avoid the guilt and feelings of inadequacy that you struggled with at times? My mom didn't seem to suffer from the guilt that I do. Do you see it shifting from generation to generation?
I mean, it's so interesting because my mother had no guilt either. And to be clear, she had a lot to feel guilty about, right? But none. Like,
she really
didn't.
She wasn't like, you know, holding it in. She literally didn't have any.
No, no. I think she feels like the best mother in the world, which is mind boggling. And we even had this conversation once when I was, when I just had my kids and we were talking about spanking. And I said, oh my God, mom used to hit us so much. And she said, I never hit you, not once. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And she said, no, 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 honey. I mean, I yelled a lot, but I never hit you. And I was like, oh, wow. Like, that's such an interesting thing about human psychology. And I just remembered, because it felt aggressive, that she was hitting me, but it was really just yelling. And oh my God, I yell so much. My kids, oh, that's terrible. And then she sent me a pile of my journals from when I was a girl. And they're full of like, mom hit me today. And mom, I'm like, what the? She fucking gaslighted me. Or she remembers
doesn't remember.
Yeah, that she was so awesome. She just like put that out of her head because it doesn't fit the narrative. So, but then here I am, like we all are, the disease of our generation, tortured by constant shame and guilt. So I don't know. I mean, I think I don't know if there's anything I can say to them that will make them feel less guilty. But like, weirdly, I think that self-loathing jar helps a lot. Like, I do think that them being conscious and, to be clear, disdainful about how shitty I feel about myself, like, it has really helped them move beyond it. So like, my younger daughter is so, she just feels so sorry for me that I have this body image dysmorphia. Like, it makes her sad for me. Like, oh man, you know, It's so depressing for mom that she doesn't like what she sees when she looks in the mirror. And I think, you know, I think hopefully that model, like the opposite modeling, will help. And I think the fact that we are unambivalent in a sense and how much we love them. I'm a very ambivalent mother in many ways about like what I should be doing, what I shouldn't be doing, how much I should be doing, how much I shouldn't be doing. But the kind of baseline attention and love, I think, is what will save them. I mean, they got so much of that from both me and my husband. So fingers crossed. Also, he doesn't feel any guilt at all. And he's such a present dad. So Maybe that's a good model for them.
No, but we've talked about that too on this show, how it is there is one person in the partnership, whether it's two men, two women, heterosexual, not whatever. There is one person that doesn't feel any guilt.
Right. It's amazing. Yes. And I don't, well, you know, like, part of it is that when it's a guy, part of it is how much credit they get for doing like literally nothing. I mean, my husband was once at the grocery store. I think I write about this in the book with a baby. And the baby was chewing on a twist tie, chewing on a piece of metal. My husband was just like standing there buying whatever, like spacing out as he always does. And some woman comes up to him and she's like, "Oh, you're such a great dad." And I mean, try to think, what would you have to do to have a stranger tell you you were a good mother? I mean, it's like you would have to, you know, do the Heimlich on a choking baby while doing, you know, SAT prep with the other one and breastfeeding twins at the same time. If right. you were doing all that, someone might be like, "Oh, good." Or someone else might be like, "Oh, man, you have too many kids, lady." Right. Or like what I always get, which are those all yours? Like, no, I just collect other people's children and put them in my minivan because that's what I do.
Well, the most my husband has been hit on was when he would go walking with our baby, whether it was in a stroller, whether it was in a, you know, what? Baby Bjorn or carrying, would get the most hit on when he was with a baby.
You know, is that just like because he's safe or is that because you want to fuck the guy who has a baby?
You want a guy who can take care of a baby, who wants to take care of a baby. You know, I did a show called The Unicorn. It's based on a friend of mine who's, not my friend of mine's neighbor, whose wife died of brain cancer and he had two young girls when she died. And the idea is that once he became single again and they put his profile on the internet, it was this, you know, dad with two daughters.
Oh my God, everyone must have went crazy.
Hit. Right. And then one of the girls calls him a unicorn because everybody wants this guy. Right, right. If you put a woman on a dating profile,
you'll never get laid again.
Rush Limbaugh used to be like, "Don't date a woman with kids." You know, just this idea of like a woman with two children, no one gives a shit. A guy taken care of lovingly, one daughter tying her shoes, you know, you're go home and masturbate. I don't know. It's like,
I know. Like I always talk, you know, I get a lot of email from, because of that article, because I talk about like wanting to fuck my husband. I get a lot of email from guys like, you know, vaguely hitting on me, asking for advice with their wife. And it's not because like they're so deeply attracted to a 5 foot tall, you know, Jewish lady with, you know, who's plumper than the average Los Angeles mom. But it's because they want to get laid and they want their wives to, these are the ones in heterosexual marriages, to think of them in the way that I say that I think about my husband, which is I also do. I mean, I idolize my husband in many ways. I'm crazy about him. And what I always tell these guys is like, unload the dishwasher, you know, push the Swiffer around. There's literally nothing sexier to a woman with small children than a guy doing a load of laundry.
Yes. Okay. So that you talk about that in your book, and there's this questionnaire you talk about.
Oh yeah, that's such a great one.
And
oh,
we were actually looking for it, and we were thinking of going home and doing it with our partners.
You should. It's so enlightening.
What I wanted to talk to you about, and this is from a, I was confused by it because now, granted, I'm also not an, I didn't, you know, Josh and I didn't get married and, or have this baby together while living together, whatever. So we're in a slightly different relationship, but like I do, when you talked about the division of labor in typical households, it was like the woman does 24 hours of work and the man does like 12. I felt like, I mean, and granted, I haven't really done, but I was like, I think I do more than that. You know, like, I mean, I do more of the taking care of. And almost hard for me to even think about, he does do the dishes after every meal, you know?
Right.
But I do most of the cooking and I do the laundry because I have to make sure that her clothes have been looked at,
right.
scrubbed, put, you know, and I don't like the way he folds and he doesn't like the way I fold.
Right. I mean, I think there's all those tasks that we think about right away. And then there's like the emotional labor. Like the one that I love is, when's the last time? And again, we're talking about people who are like in relationships with men, but like, when's the last time the guy you're married to or in a relationship with bought a birthday present for a party for another kid? That was the killer. Because I was like, I have the most egalitarian relationship on earth. And then I read that one and I was like, oh, never. I mean, and then, of course, I mean, Michael immediately started doing it. But like, I, when my kids were small, I had a present closet for birthdays because every goddamn weekend, you're just like, so I would just have this closet full of age-appropriate presents that I would buy at the post-Christmas sales. And just be like, all right, we're doing this. And
it's a great idea, by the way.
It's so genius.
I have it. I've always had, it went from a present box to a present drawer to now a present closet.
Yeah, because I mean, how much of your time is spent going to birthday parties?
And it's so going out that last minute beforehand, it just sucks.
It's
terrible. Pay way too much money.
Pay too much money and then you're rushing. But then that was the one I was like, oh, it's not like he stocked the damn present closet. And there are other things like, who remembers to make the dentist appointments? I mean, all of that is like task-oriented, emotional and intellectual labor that we don't count, that I only started counting because I saw it in that survey. And my husband definitely did more of the on-the-ground, on-the-floor parenting, playing. I'm not like a huge Lego person. And he and my kids love to draw. They'll like sit around the table, even now that they're also grown up, and draw. But I never did that. I can't draw. I'm not interested. I like to do things like read a book while you're drawing. Like mommy can like, you know, do that. But
read a book by yourself?
By myself. Just read my own book. Like while the kids are drawing, like I can be in the same room reading a book. Isn't that good? We're all together. Mommy's reading something and you're, you know, you can read too. What about silent reading? What about family silent reading? But then when I started realizing, oh man, you know, I do so much of this stuff. That I kind of started giving myself more credit for, because my husband did all the cooking too. And I felt like this, you know, that was another reason I felt like I was so much worse than all these other moms because I didn't do any of that stuff. But then I started like adding that stuff to the equation and it was really enlightening.
And I think that's something I need to do because I'm, again, very similar to you. My husband does all the cooking, all the cleaning, all the grocery shopping for the most part, all the planning of the meals. He does all of it.
Right.
And he does laundry. He does all of it. He does the stains. He does the folding. Wow. He does everything. But I go to all the basketball games. I buy all the presents. I make all the point. I do all the emotional heavy lifting. And I do find myself being like, well, that's the least you could do is all of that stuff if I'm doing all of this stuff. But yet, I still think that I am taking it for granted because when I talk to other moms or I talk to just other people in relationships – and other dads, I get it from other dads are like, do you realize how lucky you are? I mean, you must have sex with your husband every night to thank him for
doing the things that every other mother is doing all the time.
Right. And I was like, so do you have sex with your wife because she's doing it all the time? And I got this look like, what? Like, so it is very, it is so interesting.
Weren't we supposed to be done with this? Like, right? Our mothers fought these battles in the 70s. Weren't we supposed to be like so beyond the necessity of a feminist revolution at this point? How did this happen?
Listen, when I was reading your book about your mother, I mean, I have always had almost rageful jealousy of anyone who had a feminist mother because my mother was so conservative.
Really?
And is still, you know, she was a very good mother in a lot of ways, but like she never talked to me about sex. She never talked to me about my period. Like,
how did you know you, like, did you read Are You There, God?
Well, we had a sex ed class, of course. Yeah. I read Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. I think someone came and talked to us, but like, I got I don't know how this happened, but somebody sent me maxi pads in the mail.
Just a random stranger.
The guy who lived on the corner. It was weird. Just a box of a present would be maxi pads on the porch. This is such a weird story to tell, and since you're here,
yeah, no, I want to hear all about your period.
I was living. Thank you.
I got a great idea. We should be handing out tampons and maxi pads at Halloween.
Totally, because you don't know what kid is coming door to door without the access,
or if it's teenagers, age appropriate condom.
Yeah, right. Sorry. Just a little gift bag. But I I would get, I think it was like I had a 17, like a subscription to 17. Right. And so because 17 magazine was coming to my house, so, you know, Kotex was sending me, sending me their products. But thank you, 17. And I think I got them at like, I don't know where I got, but I had like a, I would put them in a bag in my closet when I was like 11 or 12. And then the worst possible thing happened. Crazy German stepfather found the bag. I was like, what is this? What is this? What are you doing?
What, like, did he think like you were going to, you know, fashion one out of dish towels?
They were like used. I had, because I was afraid to put them in the garbage.
Oh no, the used one?
I was so afraid. I know, it's really gross.
Oh my God. Maybe we can cut it off.
I know, right?
Thing.
I know.
No, that makes me really sad.
It is. It is so very
sad.
But my mom just didn't have.
We're like talking about shame. It all comes back to shame over and over
again. I know,
again.
But and that's why and you also say something in your book about how you have to stop believing your mom after 30.
It's like 55 years almost.
And I try because my dad was, you know, this one way, but my mom, like, she just didn't have the language or the, you know, she had her first kid at 20 and she was always this really beautiful, like, and then my dad was kind of, he was a rager. So she kind of, she started having kids and just became a child, was like one of the children herself. So anyway, so I think, I don't know, I've told the tampon story, maxi pad story, which I didn't mean to tell.
I like that story.
It's a little weird.
I don't remember where I was going.
No, but it's not, because I think it, you know, again, it harks back to something we talked about on a past. Do you remember what you're going to say?
Oh, just the idea of having, like you said about the seven, like, didn't our mothers fight for this? And I think this is what's really important for us to understand right now, is that some of our mothers, a lot of them fought for it.
Right.
And a lot of them did not. And they did not, you know. That's why when we there's a growing up of that. You know, I'm the only, well, I'm a little sister too, but she didn't have the same mom. I'm the only one on my side that's sort of like, I'm a feminist. And
really,
but even part of me is like sometimes like not closeted, but when I, in order to not create rifts, I am a quiet,
right?
Other than like on my Instagram to my family, because I don't, otherwise it will turn into, I don't know. It's something it's a battle I'm not as interested in fighting.
Well, you want like to have the, I mean, at some point you don't want to fight with your family. You want to have their loving relationship. Everybody has to keep secrets, not secrets, but you choose not to bring stuff up at the table if you want to maintain a loving relationship with your family.
And I do agree that our parents have such a different memory of parenting us than we do as kids being parented by them. And I'm constantly fascinated when I say something to my mom and she's like, I didn't do that. Well, where do you think the memory came from? You think I just made that up?
I know.
You know?
And are they gaslighting us, or maybe they just don't remember? And I'm sure that our kids will have like, remember when you did that? And I'll be like, oh, I never did. But
I think, look, I can't remember what happened yesterday. So if by the time my kid has,
I know, right?
I know.
How am I going to remember what I did, you know, 5 years ago? I mean, and then it'll be like 30 years ago. I mean, I don't know. Not that I'm giving anybody an excuse for saying I never did that. But it is funny because I have a sister who's older and both of us will say to my mom, no, you did that, mom. And it's two people's memories, right? It's not just
right now. Once you start to outnumber her.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm going to give my mother credit for something because of your period story. So when I got mine, I was babysitting and I called my mother hysterical and she was like, okay, just breathe, go to the bathroom by the master bedroom. So I went in and she's like, start opening drawers. And I opened the drawers and I said, okay, tampons. And she's like, all right. No big deal. Just, you know, she talked me through. And what neither of us realized at the time was it was a super plus tampon.
Oh my God, your very first experience.
And yeah, at 13. And I'm like, wow, this is not, how do people do this? This is just, and I like waddled home and my mother gave me the tampons she had got for me, which were those like little, you know, junior slant. And I'm like, wait, what? What? There's like, yeah. So that was my first experience. So
that's a good point. It's like having all sizes.
Yes.
I don't think I went to those super plus until I was a little bit older.
Dude, I was like after I had my children. Right. That's when I was like, I can handle this now.
to wrap up the period story, should you all feel like, you know, what I did do, which was my own self-care, was when I was ready, when I moved to LA, I started volunteering as a speaker for Planned Parenthood.
Oh, good for you.
And I taught sex ed, and I taught children about, I would go to schools in ninth grade, which is kind of funny that you just, people came are doing it in sixth, I get it. But I would teach, you know, healthy bodies. I taught them about how the period worked, nothing to be ashamed of. Awesome. I taught about, you know, how the menstrual cycle works, how, you know, the penis produces sperm. And then I taught about how pregnancy happens, and then STDs and how to take care of yourself and numbers to call, because I wanted, you know, I was like, I didn't get this, so I'm going to make sure you do.
That's awesome.
You know, so it did. It's, I mean, it was sad, but it also empowered me and set me free.
So Rosie, my 18-year-old, when she was in high school, she went to Berkeley High School, big, huge public school in Berkeley. And she created the first Berkeley sex column in the Berkeley Jacket. Mm-hmm. So her whole thing was dispelling myths about sex. And she's this like tiny, little, adorable, sexually inexperienced, certainly at the time, young woman. And she was just such a baller in this column. So she would say things like, you know, you don't need that extra large condom. If I can fit it over my head, you can fit it on your penis. And she would be like, your vagina is a self-cleaning oven. No douches, no, you know. And it was just,
I used to say that at Playboy.
Exactly. You did? It was so great. She was just so funny about stuff like that. And she was like, she had one called the pullout game, which basically the point was, you want to get pregnant? Try the pullout game. So, oh my
God. Was she sexually active already at that time?
I don't think so. Nope.
And she was how old?
She was 15. And she just, she was like, enough is enough with this ignorance. And she just kind of like went on she did it for the whole year. It was amazing. It was so great.
Look, I think, to go back to the question of are we changing every generation, yes, we are. Yeah. Thank God. Because I do think more things are being talked about and not being shamed for and not being hidden and not be getting secret. And, you know, I've been talking to my 11-year-old about getting her period and tampons, because now in fifth grade at her school, they started talking about it in co-ed classes. They didn't do that at my school. Like,
I don't remember ever
boys
having
were
those classes.
Not aware of what tampons were, or that girls had periods and what it does to them emotionally. And so I do think we are changing. And I think it's going to hopefully help our kids not carry a guilt, because we talk about it more. We talk about moms shaming each other for quote unquote, you know, what they think is being bad versus what is being good and all that kind of stuff. So that makes me excited. I want to talk to her about everything, and I don't want to feel like something is off the record to share with her, you know, from a mom to a daughter.
I'm really grateful for the Me Too movement as a mother too, both for my daughters and my sons, you know, for my daughters to like, I feel like it sets this tone of complete empowerment. I feel like it lets them know what's out there, but also what they don't have to tolerate. And I, you know, when I think back on the shit that I just accepted, you know, like, so I heard that Les Moonves had said about one of my pilots, ugh, I don't want another Ayelet Waldman emasculated male character. Because I had this, like, I always have these men who are like my husband, who are like really supportive, and their women's career, their wives' careers come first, or their girlfriend's careers come first, or they're gay or whatever. I hear this. And what was my reaction to that? Like, oh man, what's wrong with me that I keep writing these emasculated male characters? Well, my reaction should have been, fuck you, you piece of shit. Which, hello, has been proven to be the appropriate reaction in that instance. But I'm so glad that my daughters are now seeing and being empowered to not accept the kind of things that even me in this post-feminist generation was like, oh, I guess I have to tolerate that.
Sort and, of ingrained, you know, it's like inside our bodies.
And for you guys, I mean, how many times did you deal with that kind of shit? as actresses. And
I remember, like, I was like, I haven't really had that many things. And then that one by one, little things would happen. I remember this, I did this movie once, and it was my very first movie that somebody had dropped out of, and I ended up getting at the last second. I had to a rehearsal at the director's house, and he was playing the main character, and I was his girlfriend. And he said, we should probably practice the kissing scene, right? And that whoever was there, you know, monitoring, I had just left, had to go somewhere. And I was, so he literally asked me to practice the kissing scene alone in his apartment.
And he wasn't even going to be.
No, he was the guy.
Oh, he was the guy.
But he's like, we should practice the kissing scene. So it's not, you know, tomorrow it's not. And then it turned into this makeout session on his, like, I was so, and then I remember being like, oh, that doesn't feel right. But I was like, okay, I don't know, you know.
Ugh.
And then I was just like, ugh.
You know, I mean, I certainly had plenty of experiences of just like being a young woman and having that situation where I was like, oh, I don't want to sleep with this guy, but like, it's going to be such a thing, right? I'm going to say no. And then he's going to argue. It's just going to, oh, you know what? It's going to be 2 minutes. I know it's going to, I'm just going to let him fuck me. And then I can be out of this apartment in 2 minutes. And I don't think my daughters are going to make that stupid decision. I think they're just going to be like, fuck you, and walk out the door.
Yeah. I mean, look, I was definitely a young girl who felt if I just had sex with the boys, they would like me. Now, I didn't in hindsight realize that they would then leave me because they got what they wanted right out of me. And so it was like, well, you know, I mean, anyways, that's like a... That's a whole nother thing. The realization.
A different podcast.
That's a whole nother podcast. But it is true. It's like we used our bodies when we were younger. We were coming up in a time that was we were using our bodies to show, to get attention. Whereas now I think the girls growing up are not. Mm-hmm. Most of them. There right are still some that are, obviously.
Yeah, obviously.
But I can only focus on mine.
Right. Exactly. Although I've definitely had like moments, you know, where the kid will call. It's usually around when they're like 14, 15. They come downstairs and you're like, I hear my mother's voice like, are you wearing that? You know, it's like, what? Like how much, you know? And at first I would just be like, no, you can't go out like that. That's just ridiculous. You know, you have to cover up a little more. And then I thought, you know what? Who gives a shit? And let them express themselves and let them, you know, feel a sense of bodily agency. But I still hated it. I hated it for so long. And then my older daughter went off to Wesleyan and started dressing like a gas station attendant, like a cute gas station attendant, you know? And that's kind of, now she's on this whole Diane Keaton thing where like the shoulders are this big and the skirts are this long and it's totally adorable. And her younger sister is still a little bit into the midriff top, but she also, it's like, you know, she has a look that's not the same as her look when she was in it's like the middle school to early high school era where you just feel so uncomfortable. And I like there's an essay in my book that I call Sexy Witches in Cereal mm-hmm. Boxes where
which
it's
is
like
hilarious.
It's like, which do you have? Is your mm-hmm. daughter going to be wearing like a box or is she going to be wearing for Halloween or is she going to be a sexy witch? And I had a sexy witch and then my younger daughter – she never wore a box, but she dressed in like male characters for years, like Sherlock Holmes, Oscar Wilde. Oscar Wilde was particularly challenging. The other children did not know what she was.
You have to really
had to explain the whole thing to everyone.
It is funny. I do. Halloween is such an interesting study of personalities right from children to adults.
Right.
And everybody gets to play out these characters that they don't feel comfortable enough playing out on mm-hmm. a daily basis. And some of them are evil and sinister and some of them are sexy and crazy and some of them are just dorky. Like it's I love watching it. I don't like Halloween. It's not my thing. But it is fun to see. I always want to give her the reins mm-hmm. to see what she's going to do. And she never chooses the sexy. She doesn't really even understand what that is. And when she sees some of her friends dressing up like that, she's like,
what was she this year?
A teenage alien or an alien teenager, but it was in like a giant oversized tie-dye shirt.
There's a lot of tie-dye out in space.
Exactly. But seeing pictures of her with like other kids in her grade and what they dressed as, I was like, oh, wow, that's okay. You know, and I never pass any judgment. I never make comments about it. I let her do that to just see where her head's at. And it's really fun. It's so fun.
You're fun.
What did you do for Halloween? Four is so cute.
She was, she had some, she has a bunch of costumes. So, so at school, she was a flamingo and then, she was a bell. It was very cute.
Missy, you know what I love, right?
Me.
Yes. But besides that, I love Four Sigmatic. We talk about it all the time. And I have now been trying their new chai latte mushroom mix with turkey tail and reishi. Those are mushrooms, okay? It's crazy, it's weird, but it's sweet and dairy-free, and it helps your gut. We all need gut help. And it's caffeine-free, though, vegan, certified paleo, and the reishi supports a good night's sleep.
Why don't you get a room? Four Sigmatic products are mushroom-based. They don't taste mushroomy. They use functional mushrooms and adaptogens by incorporating them into mainstream products.
Yeah, like you could add it to lemonade or cacao or tea. And that's why you'll never get bored with Four Sigmatic, because you can always try something new. And you can even mix the packets into your ice cream. You can put it on your kids' ice cream.
Listen, they make me feel great. The coffee with cordyceps is delicious. And cordyceps have been studied for their strong antioxidant properties. So what's not to love? Get excited, because right now you can receive 15% off your Four Sigmatic purchase. Go to foursigmatic.com/motherload or use our discount code motherload at checkout.
That is 15% off if you go to foursigmatic.com/motherload. That's MOTHERLOAD or use code motherload at checkout.
You spend a third of your life in the sheets. Don't you want them to be insanely comfortable?
Bow, chicka, bow now. It's holiday season. So it is time to gift the ones you love.
Or yourself.
With something a little cozier. Like bedding, loungewear, towels, trust me, and more. They will keep them forever.
Yeah, and lucky for you and me, because Constance is doing this for me for the holidays, Brooklinen is having their biggest sale yet this Black Friday through Cyber Monday.
Brooklinen has it all. Do you like softness, comfort, essentials to help you relax?
Sort of. They are so confident in their product. All their sheets, comforters, towels, they come with a lifetime warranty.
Honestly, best gift ever. The only way to access to their biggest event ever and free shipping is to go to brooklinen.com. That is brooklinen.com before December 3rd.
And if you're just hearing this and it's post Black Friday / Cyber Monday, you can still use the promo code motherload at brooklinen.com for 10% off and free shipping anytime.
Brooklinen, everything you need to live your most comfortable life.
I was hoping we could just, if you wouldn't mind, you know, we don't have a, I don't want to keep you forever, but like, was hoping we could talk a little bit about your other book.
My microdosing with LSD book.
Do you mind talking about that a little bit?
Because no.
I am so fascinated and want to, it sounds it's like something I'm interested in.
Yes. Well, this is what I'll say about that. There is incredible research going on right now about using psychedelics to sort of a medical use for psychedelics. There's like the whole spiritual enlightenment, blah, blah, blah. But that's not really what I was interested in. That's not what I wrote about. There's amazing research going on right now at Johns Hopkins. There's research at UCLA Harbor right here, NYU, all over England, in Israel, using psychedelic drugs to treat depression, to treat anxiety, to treat addiction. So opioid addiction, there's incredible success with nicotine addiction, alcohol addiction. And it's, you know, these are really potent drugs that change your, that sort of impact the same serotonin receptors that SSRIs do, but they seem to do it with fewer side effects and with more efficiency and more effectiveness. I have a mood disorder and I have taken a lot of SSRIs. I've taken mood stabilizers. I've taken all sorts of drugs. Nothing's really worked. And like, I sometimes feel if my doctor had said to me, hey, I have this drug that's designed to make you really fat and completely lose your sex drive. Sometimes some people feel a little bit better when they take it. But hey, do you want to try that fat sex destructive medication? That would be like a much better description of SSRIs than what actually he prescribed them for. So there's all this great research about psychedelics, but I'm not the kind of person who's going to do like a big on psychedelic trip. I'm not like, you know, Hollywood is full of these ayahuasca circles. I do not need to have propulsive diarrhea in front of a room full of my friends. I'm not going to do that. But microdosing, taking small doses of psychedelics, almost the way you would take a medication, really appealed to me. So I did this experiment where I microdosed for a month, and I had started, I was really depressed, like profoundly depressed. I was in that kind of perimenopausal phase before menopause where you're just, your hormones get all out of whack. And it was kind of miraculous. It like knocked my depression out like that. And over the course of the period that I did it, I just, it was like I had more room in my head. So I could focus on therapy in ways that I hadn't before. I could do all the, you know, my therapist was a cognitive behavioral therapist and was always having me, asking me to like fill out worksheets. And I just, ugh, I wouldn't do them, or I didn't want to do them. Or, but now I was really open to doing that kind of stuff and really receptive to the messages. And it really changed my life. It was amazing.
How do you sustain it when you're not on it?
You can't really. Like, so the larger doses seem to have a longer term effect. So like you could do a larger dose. People have done larger doses with a guide, with a therapist, have done the integration work before and after, which is really important. And then that seems to sustain like for months and months. And sometimes it can crack open a depression and end it. The microdosing, it's kind of like an SSRI. You got to keep doing it if you want to have the results. And when I published my book, I became this kind of, you know, public face of psychedelics, and Donald Trump was president.
Yes, I did.
And I just was really afraid. Like, I have these children, and, you know, social services can take your kids even if you're not convicted of a crime. So
that's how I feel about this podcast.
Yes, exactly. They're going to come in like, oh my God. But so I decided to stop doing it. But there's no doubt in my mind I would still be doing it if it were legal.
It will be legal one day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's why they're doing all the studies, correct?
Well, they're doing all the studies because PTSD is intractable and depression is intractable. And the current medications we have aren't working. And then there's this drug, these different drugs, you know, LSD, psilocybin, that seem to be really, really effective. I mean, the PTSD research is insane. The, you know, PTSD is almost impossible to cure. We have a wholesale PTSD crisis in the military, you know, women who've suffered sexual assault, first responders. And MDMA, which is what we call ecstasy, is incredibly effective in curing treatment-resistant PTSD, like nothing else does. It's amazing.
Did you tell your kids you were doing it when you were doing it?
No, I told them after. Mm. I didn't tell them during, although there was this insane moment where I was like, I'm a horrible person in the morning. I don't like mornings. I'm shitty. I'm mean. I just kind of sit there hunched over a cup of tea. You know, it's not my thing. My husband's like a ray of sunshine in the morning. I don't understand it. So I was doing this and I would wake up and I would just be like, la, 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 making pancakes this morning and like make my kids lunches and being all like cheerful. And my daughter looked at me one morning and she's like, what the hell? Are you on acid? And I was like, what? Why would you say that? But I told them, I wrote a book about it, right? So I told them afterwards, and the kids, the older ones were like, oh my God, that's so cool. My friends are going to love that. And the youngest one was like, oh my God, I don't want my mommy to be the LSD mommy in middle school. But, you know, we talked it through, we worked it out. And my rule is that I won't say anything about your life unless I have permission, but I get to say the things about my life. And now he's like totally stoked by it. You know, he just started boarding school, and I think it's actually, you know, amusing to him that people are like, whoa, man, your mom.
Was that his idea to go to boarding school?
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by kids that voluntarily want to go to boarding school.
You know, he struggled a little bit in, not academically, but socially, sort of making his way in school when he first started high school at Berkeley High. And he's the youngest of four and is really used to having, he loved, I mean, he started getting sort of sad about Sophie going to college when she was 14. I mean, he just hated the idea that the house was going to empty out. And he would describe this feeling of like everybody leaving and just him being alone with no kids as, you know, my kids are like a pack. They're like a little wolf pack. And so at some point I was like, you know, there's a way you could be surrounded by other kids. And he looked at it and he liked the idea, and we were very open to him starting, but also if it didn't feel good coming home. And so far, it's only been a couple of months, but so far it's been kind of great.
It's really interesting because when I moved to Tennessee, I became an only child and I was alone in the house with my, you know, lusty parents and a stepdad mom. And I went to Governor's School for the Arts in like one summer after my sophomore year. And I met a girl who went to a boarding school, and she told me about it. And I was desperate to go. Like something about that environment where you were around people, I wouldn't have to go home and be the only kid. And like and it's interesting because I had had that and then it was over.
Right.
So there's something kind of interesting to me about the fact that I too, if we could have afforded it. I also had a really good drama program.
I talk to my son every day. We text, we talk, and our conversations are never about, I don't nag. I don't need to nag. They have a whole superstructure that, you know, he has 2 hours a day where he has to do homework. And there's someone else who makes him do his homework. And there's like a disciplinary thing. Like all I do is talk about fun stuff. So he'll call me and he'll like, you know, we'll talk about current events, or we'll talk about the people he meets, or we'll talk about, he talks a lot about mountain biking, like a lot. We talk a lot about mountain biking. That's a thing. We talk about whitewater kayaking a lot. We talk about the river. We talk about how you scope the rapids, and, you know, they're conversations I never expected to have, but I'm doing my research. I'm figuring it out.
How old is he?
He's 16.
Oh, he's 16. Okay. Yeah. See, I just don't know. I mean, there's one thing about letting go of my kid when she's supposed to be gone, which is college. I don't know if I would be able to let go of her sooner than that.
Well, we weren't with Sophie. You know, she raised the issue of going to boarding school, and we were like, she sort of looked at Andover, and we were, you know, theoretically supportive, but putting every roadblock that we could. And when she did go to college, I mean, we were out of our minds. At one point, we were at dinner, the five of us who were left, and Michael says, okay, come on, people. She's not dead. We all need to stop crying, because we were all crying. Abe like put his hand, he's the little one, he put his hand in his pocket and he took out a BART ticket and he said, this is from when Sophie and I went to San Francisco together. And we were all just like wailing. But, you know, it gets easier every time they leave. I still cry so hard dropping my kids off at school. Like my son's a senior at Bard, and every time he goes back to school, I'm just like, now I cry because the house he rented with his friends is so disgusting that the idea of leaving him in this vermin infested shithole makes me very sad. And I also do this, like, I do this kind of distance mothering where, you know, it's cold. And I don't know about you, but my grandmother used to call me anytime the weather was bad. She'd be like, it's raining in Northern California. Are you okay? And I'm doing the same thing. It's like, it's gotten really cold on the East Coast and it's unusually cold. I'm like, my son must have received 20 pairs of socks and sweaters and heat, like hand warmers. And he told me once that sometimes he doesn't wake up for breakfast, you know, in time to go to breakfast. And I like inundated him with pumpkin bread to the point he's like, okay, no, we need to stop with the pumpkin bread.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's weirdly, I know I realize I sound like I'm making excuses, but it really has made us, the two of us, closer in a way that's really nice. It's like conflict-free parenting, which is not a thing with teenagers.
Well, because I was going to say, it feels more like you can now be a friend instead of a parent.
Yeah. Well, I'm definitely a mom. I mean, in a way, it's a more friendly relationship. But like when he was home, there was a tremendous amount of disciplining going on, and it just, you know, there were not a lot of these lovely interactions that you really value having your kid with your kids. And now they're really nice. Yeah. Like he routinely calls me when he's cleaning his dorm room. So we FaceTime and we'll just, he's like, you know, killing time and he wants some entertainment. And
but what's next for you now that you have no kids?
Can I just add, yeah, can sorry, I say sorry. One thing before you go? Because I know we need to, but I wanted to go back to your on-off parenting thing, just to, as you were talking about, you know, these high school kids. And I think you don't really have as many on-off moments. I could be wrong with them as you do with the little ones.
Yes.
And I think that the reason you want it to go, at least for me, because that's kind of where I am, when I want it to be off, I mean, it's mostly because something is happening that I don't know what the fuck to do.
Right.
I try all the right moves and it doesn't work. You know, she's still wanting to hit me and
or having a tantrum.
Having a tantrum, you know, and I'm trying everything right. And it just is like, I mean, oh, obviously there's the mundane aspects of it too, but those were not nearly as hard for me. It's just when it was just like chaos. And mm-hmm. then, you know, and I think like us talking about it and it all right. just being like, yeah, this is so hard. It does help.
My advice, as delightful as it is, just don't spend too much time on Chrissy Teigen's Instagram feed, because that is the place where I look at it and I'm like, oh, I suck. Look at all the amazing parenting she's doing.
So, okay, what's next for you?
So what's next for me is I'm doing A Really Good Day, the microdosing memoir. I'm making kind of a scripted series out of that, starring Anna Chlumsky at Showtime. Cross your fingers that goes. There's another project that I'm super excited about that I'm not allowed to say yet because the deal is, you know, T's have not been crossed, that I'll be doing with my husband for a couple of years. It's super exciting. Also television. So I'm like a decade ahead of you guys, at least on this route. And it's kind of exhilarating to be in this phase where, oh, I'm, you know, I can actually focus on my career in a way that I couldn't when I had kids. And, I feel sort of the way I felt when I was in my mid-20s, like, oh my God, you know, shit's starting to happen and it's so exciting. I'm moving faster because I feel like I have less time.
But isn't it crazy that a lot of your career is because you had kids?
Right, exactly. Like, you know, the stuff that people, you know, it's so ironic. Like I did try to do things to, you know, I made professional sacrifices on the one hand, but on the other hand, like everything I do, like motherhood has made my literary career 100%. I mean, for a long time, I was like the resident bad mom. You know, Amy Chua is a, you know, her children are all going to Harvard. Here, let's call that shitty mom to come up and, you know, write an essay about the terrible things that Western moms do. Or the Today Show wants someone to talk about how crappy it is to go on vacation with your children. And they're like, oh, we know who will hate a vacation. Let's call Ayala Waldman.
But so, it's true, because people are not willing to show the dark side.
Right.
And everybody wants it to be, you know, bubbles and candy.
Bubbles and cotton candy.
Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you guys so much. It was a real pleasure.
Wow. Ayelette, man.
I could have probably just sat there for another couple of hours.
Oh, I had so many things I wanted to talk to her about. Too. And I wanted her to tell me, and I wanted her to say it's all, I mean, look at her. She is a perfect product of, I got it. I made some choices that were very hard choices, but I did it. And now she's thriving because of being a parent, because a lot of what her success is from being a parent.
Well, I also think like just how radically honest she is about the tribulations of parenting and like her personal struggles with her abortion and like all of these things that I struggle constantly with what to say about a certain thing. Like, I don't want it to come out the wrong way. I'm worried someone will think this. I don't have the world's greatest relationship. I'm not as good, but like honest relationship with my family, because we believe things so differently. Like, we respect each other, but it gets kind of convoluted. And I really admire someone that is that honest, is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
I aspire to that level of honesty. Although sometimes it kind of scares me. Like some of the things she said, like I kind of needed a minute to be like, okay.
Yeah. But what scares us makes us stronger.
That's true.
So there you go.
There are no small mistakes, only
big fuck ups.
Yeah. Anyway.
Anyways, that was amazing. I can't believe we got her on our show. That makes me very, very proud that all of you who don't know about her, go read her books. She's incredible.
Oh, and also, if you guys have a book that you love and you want us to bring an author on that, you know, we may not know of, let us know. DM us at MotherloadPod.
And now we would like to thank our beautiful sponsors.
Don't forget that with the Flamingo Shave Set, you can upgrade for less or the same as you're paying now. It comes with the Flamingo Razor, foaming shave gel, body lotion, shower hook, and reusable travel pouch.
Get your Flamingo Shave Set for just $16 with free shipping today when you visit shopflamingo.com/motherload. That's shopflamingo.com/motherload. It's a good stocking stuffer. Remember, you know your child better than anyone else.
And don't overthink it. You're doing a great job. Hey, 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 hey. Got the highest toys, got the lowest
lows. Yeah, I'm full of love, I'm full of love. This show is executive produced by Constance Zimmer, Missy Pyle, and Sim Sarna. Associate producer is Daniela Silva.
Editor is Wayland Productions. Music is by Josh Cook and Alicia Eagle. This is a Cloud 10 production powered by Simplecast.